From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the world. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, militias helping the displaced in Iraq, 30 years of China's one-child policy, learning Arabic in Damascus, and Rambo in Vietnam. There are an estimated 2.7 million internally displaced people in Iraq, and little is being done to help them. A new report released by the NGO Refugees International says militias are stepping into the breach. The Mehdi Army, the militia loyal to the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, is one of the groups helping the displaced communities. But it's also been recruiting new members from these people in distress. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports.
His daughter is fretful. 40-year-old Yais Huder Daoud tries to soothe her, but it's hot inside the bombed-out rooms where the family makes its home, and the child only calms down when he puts a bottle in her mouth. Daoud, a Shiite, has been squatting in this abandoned Air Force headquarters for 2 years now, since he was driven out of his South Baghdad neighborhood by Sunni insurgents.
All my neighbors left the area. Some of them were killed. Others had their houses burned. I moved here because we have no other place to be.
Like many of the estimated 2.7 million internally displaced Iraqis, he says he's had no support from the Iraqi government during all of his ordeal. Instead, a member of Muqtada al-Sadr's vast humanitarian network stepped in with an offer of help.
He came to me and told us to give him our papers, and he told me after registering us that the Sadr office would give me rations and salary and clothes.
Other IDPs here say the Sadr office has distributed meat and clothing to the community on several occasions. According to the new report by Refugees International, the largest provider of aid and social services in Iraq is now the Sadr office and its Mehdi Army militia. But the Mehdi Army is not alone. Both Shiite and Sunni militias are stepping into the vacuum left by the Iraqi state. The militias, the report says, quote, are improving their local base of support by providing social services in the neighborhoods and the towns they control. Nir Rosen co-authored the study. He spoke to NPR by phone from Beirut.
The government is doing absolutely nothing in this case. And of course, these aren't only NGOs. These are militias, military organizations, who've been fighting each other, who've been fighting the government, who've been fighting the Americans, who are implicated in abuses of civilians, expelling civilians they don't like. So you're not exactly dealing with reliable organizations with overwhelming legitimacy.
The militias have their own agendas, Rosen says, and they are also increasingly recruiting from the dispossessed. Many of the internally displaced have been deeply traumatized by their experiences and are filled with rage. Refugees International says it's become a particular problem in Sunni areas of Baghdad, where U.S.-funded Sunni paramilitary groups from the Awakening Movement operate.
Locals have been complaining that the displaced Iraqis who've joined the Awakening groups tend to be more aggressive, and then they're not loyal to the notion of the community. They're much more angry. They might not be as willing to accept that the original inhabitants, such as Shias, would return to their homes. So it is a concern when these militias somehow become entrenched.
The report warns that the IDP crisis is the most under-recognized and yet the most urgent facing Iraq right now. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
It's been 3 decades since China introduced the one-child policy, supposedly as a temporary measure. But it's still in force, and there's rising opposition and criticism that the policy is creating another demographic crisis. As NPR's Louisa Lim reports, the trends are exemplified in the city of Shanghai, which has the lowest birth rate and the highest proportion of seniors in China.
2-year-old Mao Mao is kissing her 10-month-old brother, Lulu, with encouragement from her mother. As brother and sister play in a Shanghai park, little do they realize they're a departure from 3 decades of strict family planning. Although many rural Chinese have 2 children, China still limits most urban families to just 1 child. Because Mao Mao and Lulu's parents are both only children themselves, they're among the privileged few city dwellers allowed to have 2 kids. I was lonely as a child, says their mother Zara, who didn't want her full name to be used. I was jealous of friends who had brothers and sisters. Now my friends are envious of my two children. Figures bear this out. One poll last year showed 69% of Chinese would support a proposal to abolish the one-child policy. Zara's come to the park with her mother-in-law and her mother-in-law's 81-year-old mother-in-law. All of them support China's efforts to control its population. Our leaders have thought a lot about the country's policies, the 81-year-old matriarch says. Whatever they say is right. However, demographic scholars aren't so sure. Some academics now believe the simplistic thinking behind the one-child policy could be responsible for a looming demographic crisis. Among them is Peng Xizhe, Dean of Social Development and Public Policy at Fudan University.
The major policymakers are only concerned about the total number of the population. But now China's population dynamics have become so complicated. On the one hand, we have the number is still growing. Then we have the very rapidly aging population. Then we have the issues of the bigger migration. And also we face the problem of the abnormal sex ratio at the birth.
That abnormal sex ratio means little Lulu might not find a wife, along with as many as 40 million other young men. The latest figures show 119 baby boys are born in China for every 100 girls, way above the normal ratio, because of the traditional preference for boys and the availability of abortion. The strict birth control policies have serious economic consequences too. China's limited labor pool and its aging population means it will eventually lose its position as workshop of the world, as Zhuo Xuejin, executive vice president of Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, explains.
Demographic trend is making China less competitive in labor-intensive manufacturing. We cannot compete in future with India, Bangladesh, in terms of labor-intensive manufacturing.
Indeed, the future of the one-child policy was a hot topic at this year's parliament session. But speculation that changes might be in the offing ended when Population Minister Zhang Weiqing said the policy would stay in place for another decade. The academics believe that's a mistake.
So in that way, I think that it's better to just let the family to decide how many children they want.
Fertility is a very basic right of citizens, so we should be very careful to interfere in this field in future.
One reason why they believe people should take control of their own fertility is China's rapidly aging elderly population. Here in the park, seniors far outnumber children. A staggering 20% of Shanghai's population is older than 60. Longer life expectancy and the one-child policy mean fewer workers are supporting ever more seniors. And the disintegration of a state-run social security network means many seniors now fear a lonely future.
I'm worried when I'm older, no one take care of that time. I think my life will become very terrible. Our government never worried about that.
Wang Jintao is a teacher of the erhu, a traditional two-stringed instrument similar to a violin balanced on the knee. As he prepares for his weekly class in the park with a group of seniors, he believes he's voicing the fears of an entire generation.
30 years ago, our government made a mistake. So the result is in big city. Most of people like my age, they worried about their future.
China's now galloping towards its aging future. And experts are warning the danger is not of changing the one-child policy too soon. It's of moving too late. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
Although Syria is beginning to open itself to foreign visitors, it remains a strictly controlled society. But there's one major exception to that rule. Foreign students are flocking to Syria to learn Arabic, including many Americans, despite the tense relations between the two governments. As NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Damascus, many of the foreigners find Syria a very different place from what they've been told.
Since 9/11, Arabic speakers have been in high demand in the U.S. and elsewhere. For a long time, the primary overseas destination for students of Arabic was Egypt, and that remains true today. But Damascus is seeing a growing influx of students signing up for language studies at both religious and secular schools.
Damascus University is a mix of concrete classrooms and tree-lined green spaces where young men and women gather in small groups or study alone. At the Higher Language Institute, in addition to Arabic, you can hear English, German, Italian, and Japanese being spoken by some of the many foreign students who come here to study both spoken and written Arabic.
For the American and European students here, a couple of key factors drove the decision to come to Syria, a state condemned by Western politicians as a sponsor of terrorism. First, the low tuition and cheap housing available in Damascus offer a much better deal than the American universities in Egypt or Lebanon. In addition, the Syrian dialect is considered by some to be closer to classical Arabic. British student Anise Turner had no problems convincing her parents about the move. In fact, she says it was her father, CBS News cameraman Nick Turner, who encouraged her to consider it. After 7 months here, the city's deep history and friendly inhabitants have won her over.
I love it. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. Some people maybe from the West, when they come here, they think it's a bit chaotic, but Syria, for me, is the safest country I've ever been in. I feel safer in Damascus than I do feel in London.
Sipping tea at one of the venerable old restaurants in Damascus's old city, American students Kara Francis and Ashley Milko share the positive view of Syrian hospitality, beauty, and culture. The 25-year-old Francis was studying Arabic in Washington, D.C., when she realized if she wanted to become fluent, she'd better come to the region and study intensively. She's been pleased to find a complete lack of anti-Americanism so far.
No, to the contrary. Every time I tell a Syrian that I'm American, they just get really excited and happy. And, you know, they say that they don't like Bush. And I tell them I don't either. And then Syrians can't really talk about their own politics very much. So the topic of conversation moves away from politics to things like family and schooling.
23-year-old Ashley Milko has also found common ground with young Syrians, but at the same time, she's getting a first-hand view of the problems here, and that's an important part of the experience.
I'm definitely glad I came, not only for my Arabic studies, but for gaining a more realistic, on-the-ground perspective of not only Syria, but its relation to its neighbors and its position in Middle Eastern politics. I've been really happy with how open people are. Not as many girls here wear headscarves as I thought, but at the same time, I think it's a city that's somewhere in the middle of the developing world and the developed.
So if Syria was hoping that these language programs would amount to a charm offensive among impressionable young students, Kara Francis says the reality is quite a bit more complicated, especially for a young Western woman.
I think it's easy to idealize this place before you come, and it's easy to walk around as a tourist especially and think that it's great, it's lovely, the old city is charming, people are so friendly and welcoming. But if you spend a little bit longer here, you see the bad things about this place. You see the poverty, you see how Syrian men treat you as a foreign woman. That's difficult.
All three of these young women said although they've never felt threatened, the aggressive attentions of Syrian men were difficult to adjust to. Even more of a shock was how Syrian women are treated and the lack of opportunities they face. But in the end, these students say that may be the most valuable lesson of all, not to simply be dazzled by the beauty of Damascus, but to come away with a fuller, more nuanced picture of a society that was largely opaque to them before. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Damascus.
Coming up, Rambo returns to Vietnam.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Finally this week, a postcard from Vietnam. A larger-than-life war hero and former POW has just shown up in Vietnam. And no, it's not John McCain. From Hanoi, here's NPR's Michael Sullivan.
Remember the last time Sylvester Stallone's John Rambo was in Vietnam?
The covert operations being geared up in the Far East. Your name was dug out by the computer as one of three most able to complete the mission. Recon for POWs in Nam. Nobody knows that terrain better than you do.
You interested?
Yeah.
Good.
Sir, do we get to win this time?
The year being 1985 and this being Hollywood, the answer, of course, was yes, for this mission at least, at the expense of a whole lot of Vietnamese and their Soviet advisors. Not surprisingly, Rambo 2 was banned in Vietnam, as were the other films in the series, but the new Rambo 4, with a new set of politically correct villains, Myanmar's military, has gotten a green light from Vietnam's censors and is now showing in multiplexes from Hanoi to Ho Chi Minh City. Nguyen T. Hong Thai, deputy director of the government's cinematography management department, says this Rambo was not judged by the ones that preceded it. They are independent works of art, she says, and must be evaluated accordingly. This film, she says, doesn't violate any laws about spreading information harmful to the state. Not this state, maybe, but the movie is banned in Burma, or Myanmar as it's now officially known, where the police recently swept the streets of the capital, confiscating bootleg copies of Rambo 4, filmed along the Thai-Myanmar border. A tale of mercenaries and missionaries who need Rambo's help.
People say you know the river better than anyone.
They're lying.
So what I'm asking is a few hours of your time that will help change people's lives.
Are you bringing any weapons?
Of course not.
You're not changing anything.
It's thinking like that that keeps the world the way it is.
Sylvester Stallone's character may be getting old for American audiences, but not for a new generation of Vietnamese theatergoers who were born long after the Vietnam War ended and don't know that much about Rambo's backstory, but do know a good action hero when they see one. I haven't seen Rambo 2, this college student Nguyen Van Hung says, but I've seen the others on DVD, and I like him. He tries to run from his past, but he can't, and in the end, he does something good. His date, another college student, Nguyen Hung Lam, says this is her first Rambo, and she says she likes what she saw. He's strong, he's tall, and he's muscular, she says, and he's very human. At the beginning, the student says, he doesn't want to join the fight, but then a woman convinces him to change his mind. I loved that, the student says, that a woman was able to get him to do the right thing. A kinder, gentler Rambo? Maybe the Vietnamese aren't the only ones who've moved on. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Hanoi.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.